cambiamento di programma al quadro.
Thank you very much, Elio, and I'm sorry for the change in your agenda. I'm particularly happy to have this opportunity to discuss this issue with you this afternoon. Indeed, there are a number of issues at stake here, because as doctors and nurses we always work hand in hand, so there is a number of issues which may have a quantitatively different bearing on our lives, but which we share. So what is a critical event indeed? Well, there are a number of options. There are a number of ways in which we may describe a critical event, but essentially a critical event is a disruption of our routine. So our routine is based on the programmed and pre-planned management of our work. And obviously, we work at best if we keep to the routine. Obviously, both in critical care and outside critical care, there may be unpredicted and unpredictable events which disrupt our routine, which stress the system, and the extent to which the system will be disrupted will depend greatly on the system's strength. That is to say, if the system is strong, it will be able to survive this disruption. If it is weak, it will simply fail. Anyhow, any disruption will involve a number of critical issues and problems for the people involved. So, as you have seen, I have drawn here a major and then a minor critical event, and you'll see how we can differentiate between the two. Now, there is something which we have been learning over the years, that is to say, even once a critical event is over, it should never be minimized. This doesn't mean that we should give way to despair, but simply that we should understand what its causes were and what its repercussions are on both the patient and ourselves as care providers. Now, the major critical event which is discussed in the fields of disaster medicine, even more than critical care, is a critical event which has to be managed in terms of managing the stress suffered by care providers because of the critical event itself. Now, this is something which may seem not to concern us overmuch in critical care. It's something which perhaps is more related to emergency department services or major natural disasters. You may have all seen what had happened in Chechnya after, for instance, the Beslan bomb terrorist attack. There were not just care providers, but also psychiatrists who came there and started assisting the people involved. So these are really exceptional events, really unique events, disasters, same thing which happened to the city of Milan when there was an airplane crash. And the same may also happen in cases of major road accidents. So the care providers themselves need support, and this is based on debriefing, which is defined, as you can see here. It's both a psychological and educational training process, and it's based on guidelines and standards. Now, I cannot invent a debriefing, because it is a technique which is based on professional skills. I can try and console people who are suffering from trauma, but actually debriefing is something which is normally carried out professionally. The point I would like to make is that debriefing is a technique which has a role to play not just in major disasters, but as you most certainly have all experienced, even in the ICU, there are deaths which actually affect us all much more than others. And so being able to assess, to discuss these events, to discuss them collectively in a structured way, is a way to overcome, to work out the event. Now, debriefing is therefore a complex and structured event, and I do believe that hospitals and emergency departments and services should actually start developing the debriefing technique outside exceptional situations. Now, we don't really know when debriefing is useful. It certainly would be useful in more instances than the instances in which debriefing is routinely applied today. Debriefing is something which is probably useful every time there is something which disrupts a routine to a disastrous extent, as it were. The point is that we also need a request from care providers. They must request help so that we may understand when debriefing is useful. So I've been talking about major disasters, terrorist attacks, earthquakes, airplane crashes and so on. The question is a structure such as a debriefing system useful also in our daily activity in order to face these major emotional problems which may arise, not just by discussing them among ourselves, but also by discussing these events with external professionals? Well, the point that debriefing is useful also for those who witness a traumatic event comes from this book, a book which has very recently been published by Jean-Selim Kanan, who is a UN worker and who both defends and accuses the UN. And this book contains a plea, because what it states is that peace forces, NGO workers, UN workers, are left alone in the face of these problems, of the trauma they suffer from these events. And so, let's take into account this point. The UN itself does not really provide routinely debriefing for its peace personnel, peace enforcement personnel, and so on. So obviously it's quite difficult for a small Italian hospital to provide debriefing. Yet, this does not mean that it should be ruled out. On the contrary, the point is that it's not just disasters, but also minor events which may actually be experienced as trauma. Unexpected cardiac arrest, for instance. Cardiac arrest is already stressing and stressful when it is expected. When it is unexpected, well, there can be also a moment of confusion. Someone doesn't know where the defibrillator is and so on, especially when you are taking in and hospitalizing more people than you normally do, so you're overwhelmed. And, you know, this can induce high stress, and something must be done to treat, as it were, that stress. In some cases, there may also be mistakes, a nurse's, a doctor's mistake, which may create a problem. And indeed, error is one key concept in our work, because if I make a mistake, I cause an event. For instance, I inject potassium instead of a saline solution, and I induce cardiac arrest. Or, conversely, I may have an error as a consequence, not as the cause of an event. For instance, I have to hospitalize 3-4 incoming emergency cases, one after the other, and so I end up neglecting a previous case. So, error management should really have a very high priority, while for the time being the current attitude is that of denial. Since errors should not occur, we tend to deny their existence, but we indeed although not explicitly, are all aware that errors do occur, our errors and other people's errors, but we don't like talking about it because, you know, talking too much about errors means also having to face one's responsibility, because it's not easy to forgive an error. So we prefer denial, while we should learn how to manage errors, both in terms of repairing, correcting the error, informing the patient, and also by analyzing the error, by shouldering our responsibility, and by improving the system in terms of shifts, cooperation with doctors, cooperation with the hospital system, and so on and so forth. So why should we actually raise the issue of errors in medicine and healthcare? Well, because it has a direct bearing on health, on direct and indirect costs. And if you ask not yourselves, but your friends perhaps, something about the awareness of people regarding this, and you'll find out that people are highly aware that care providers do make mistakes, do make errors. And this should not be used to discredit us. I mean, everybody makes mistakes. So we should admit that we run the risk of making mistakes. There's no shame in this. We should be ashamed if we deny that we make errors while we make them. So, recognizing them is the first step towards correcting them. This is a rather old study, but it already gives us some indications regarding the most frequent errors in healthcare. As you can see, the most frequent ones are, as it were, less severe errors. Adverse effects of drugs, wound infections, and nosocomial infections in general are errors as regards their etiology and their management, technical complications, and then some more specific aspects, such as post-op bleeding, which should not occur. Bear in mind that obviously not all errors are avoidable, but they are errors nonetheless in patient management. Some are surgery-related errors, and indeed, as regards intensive care, well, I have found no publication so far in that respect. I have just found myself directly a number of typical errors, which are typical of critical care nursing or nursing in general. I think it's something which we have been suffering from various times. Drugs not administered, or wrong or delayed administration of drug, amine pulse, or excess dose, and so on and so forth. Now, how many errors are made in the medical field? Well, this book, To Err is Human, Building a Safer Health System, is a publication by the United States National Institute of Medicine, and the estimate is the following. In the USA, there's about 1 million episodes which actually lead to patient injury, and about 100,000 deaths may be attributed to errors. If you divide these figures by 5, because we're 50 million people in Italy, I think it's 150 in the USA, well, we end up with about 20,000 deaths which may be attributed to errors. Now, this seems enormous. I'm not really sure whether it's reliable. Perhaps much here is explained in terms of statistical interpretation. However, well, if someone dies in hospital, very often it may be due to errors. It may be due to errors, which have not... errors meaning also not helping them. In percentage terms, in the United States, almost 4% of hospitalized people suffer from severe injury because of an error. And indeed, intensive care is one of the places where errors can be most harmful. So very often we make mistakes in intensive care, although these are not necessarily very severe errors. according to this USA study, so if the figures are true, well, deaths due to medical errors are 4 times as many as deaths due to road accidents. So this is quite impressive, and as you may imagine, this 1999 publication caused quite an outcry in the United States. You know, the authorities, consumer associations, the health system started saying, well, we should do something in order to improve the healthcare system, to make it safer. There is another study which gives different data. It's this study, which was published in 2002 in the New England Journal of Medicine. It's based on interviews to 830 medical professionals, doctors, and 1,200 members of the public, who were asked a number of questions. So the approach was not a statistical one. They did not go in hospitals and count the errors. The question was the following. Have you or your family experienced medical errors? Well, doctors say yes in 35% of cases. People from the public at large, 42%. And I'm talking about errors which gave rise to an injury. So we are involved too, directly. At least one third of us have suffered from such errors, and grave errors in 18% and 24% of cases respectively, i.e. doctors and public at large. Who was at the origin of the error? Well, doctors say we were responsible in 70% of cases. The public says doctors were responsible in 81% of cases. And indeed, if you think of surgery, diagnostics, and so on, it is quite clear that doctors tend to be much more exposed than nurses in that respect. But nurses are also indicated as being in charge of 25% of errors by both doctors and the public. And institutions, that is to say, the hospital, is responsible in 15% of cases for doctors and 26% of cases for the public. Now, as a patient, how often have you been told, we are sorry, an error was made? We're talking about grave errors, severe errors. Well, as you can see, only in one third of cases was the error actually communicated to the patient. In two thirds of cases, therefore, the error was denied. And it was only in one third of cases that regrets or apologies were expressed to the patient. Now, this is obviously not enough, but it's quite clear that if you are the victim of an error, at least receiving an apology, a word of apology, is something which is better than nothing. And, well, we'll know that it's not easy to say one is sorry. What about legal action? What about lawsuits? Well, despite the fact that we are in the United States, 2% of severe errors suffered by doctors and their families were the object of a lawsuit, and 6% for the general public, despite the fact that this is the United States, so in Italy it would be much less. So, the interviewees were asked, what do you think was the cause of a preventable error? Too few nurses, this is the first reply. 53% and 65% respectively, doctors and the public at large, say that the error was essentially due to a lack of nurses, which is contradictory with the fact that doctors are the first cause of errors. Then, people being overworked or stressed, 50% to 30% of cases, limited communication between the staff, high complexity of procedures, and, well, everyone understands that the more a procedure is complex, the riskier it will be, and so the more or the greater the likelihood of errors, then the limited time doctors devote to patients, and then something which you will appreciate, the fact that doctors scribble in an illegible way. So who was individually responsible. Well, individuals in slightly more than one half of cases, both doctors and nurses. The institution, the hospital that cuts resources, cuts staff, puts staff under pressure, reduces the time available for care, well, this is number two, is a cause which is identified more among doctors than in the public at large. So this indicates that we have something that we can do. To what extent medical errors and the consequences may be avoided? Well, after a long discussion and analysis, the conclusion was that about two-thirds of these errors may be avoided. But I don't know whether this is not something which concerns minor errors, which are easier to avoid and prevent. For instance, you may use a computer or a typing machine to type your instructions rather than write them in a scribble which nobody may read, but I'm not sure that more severe and complex errors may be avoided as simple as that. So we can reduce the number of errors, but to do so, first of all, we must accept the fact that we can make errors. We should not be ashamed of the fact that that we can make errors. I mean, it's not just other people, it's not just the taxman who makes a mistake when he asks us to pay $1 billion. We must change our culture, our approach to things and to life. And, you know, you can change your behavior after a procedure. As I say, you must understand that the way in which you have been acting so far was wrong, and so you must change your approach. So errors should become a true priority, and this is what would enable us to change things in truth. I believe that it is our joint duty, as regards us as doctors and you as ministers, to work together in order to reduce the number of errors. Indeed, we are professionals who do not want to cause errors and to induce injury through errors. If we accept this cultural approach, then change becomes easier. So change, what is change? Well, change does not simply mean I have to be more committed. It's not just that. It's doing something which has already been started in northern countries, Denmark, the Netherlands. It's a major cultural change which involves both the health system and the public. Again, it's essentially a cultural change. We must accept the fact that we make mistakes in order to make less mistakes in the future. So, fine words, you say, but in practice, well, suppose I'm one of these who have made an error, the other one is a nurse who has made an error. Now, what happens? Well, as you can see, we're immediately surrounded by a number of attackers who are looking for the culprit. You know, the managers of the hospital, the judges, the director of our service, the media, the professional association, the colleagues. So it's not so easy to say, I have made an error. It is the whole culture which we should create in that respect. And for instance, there are systems which provide for a sort of record of errors, an anonymous way of recording errors, not with the aim of subjecting people to a sort of ritual sacrifice, but rather in order to be able to make progress from where you are. And this progress should be quite gradual. First of all, we must become ourselves, we must become convinced ourselves that something can be made. We should start by reporting errors anonymously if necessary. This indeed might prevent the sort of witch hunt which I've been talking about. Obviously, if there is negligence or malpractice, okay, this is an individual case of liability or responsibility, but when there are systemic problems, we can all contribute to the improvement of the situation. So, the first step is not hiding the error, not minimizing the error, but rather reporting the error in an anonymous and protected way, and then we should find a way to manage the error with the patient's family, with the patient him or herself, if the patient is able to interact with us. And what is essential is to report the error to the system so that the system may be improved. Now, I have had the experience of discussing my errors with my patients, admitting my errors, explaining them, and you know, people are not stupid. They understand quite well, and this reduces enormously the number of lawsuits you have. Well, obviously, if you're actually guilty of malpractice, okay, well, there will be a trial, and that's it. But indeed, damages ought to be paid, compensation ought to be paid when someone has suffered from gross malpractice. This is quite correct, but there's no point in just attacking the system without trying to change it or correct it. So, talking with patients is a way of reducing the number of lawsuits which are not productive, and reporting and analyzing errors in the system is the only way of improving the system. And indeed, it's the national health system which should be motivated in reducing errors, because 1-3% of the hospital's budget is actually accounted for by errors, overstay in hospitals, over-prescription of drugs or more drugs which are necessary than would have been the case without errors, and so on. So some hospitals are trying to work on that, but it's not easy and it's not systematic for the time being. So we still have to make progress in that direction. Now, in that respect, we should ask ourselves a number of questions. Will we be truly able to put ourselves in question in order to change, not from today to tomorrow, but rather in a gradual process? Who will help us to understand how we can change, and who will help us, or how shall we become able to tackle, to address these critical events before they become a disaster? So perhaps we should start working on ourselves. We should express our need to discuss critical events and errors without being afraid of it, to accept our individual responsibility, taking into account the fact that individual responsibility is not the only responsibility, and this is a way also to tackle the issue of collective responsibility. And then, we should always remember that when we discuss errors, we're doing it for our own well-being, because actually we also suffer when we make mistakes, and in the interest of the patients whom we should protect and care for. Thank you very much for your attention.